You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 23rd of April, 2021. On the podcast today, Paul Hill, full-time investor and equity analyst, gives his view on the markets, and we talk about the following stocks: Avacta, Avingtrans, SourceBio, Verici DX, Telewimpy, Northbridge, Equals, and Escape Hunt. Also, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about whether UK banks show some good value at this level. And also, N Plus One singer chief economist Jamie Constable, in his monthly macro update, discusses the predicted strength of the economic recovery with Paul Hill. Plus, as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most read RNSs. You can check out both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. We'll see lots of other content. In fact, there's an article there on Barron Oil, earning there. There's one on PHC, which is plant healthcare, of course. There's an article on Oilex. There's a chat there where I talked about with Paul, actually, fund manager interview with Andy Broff of Schroders. Worth looking at. Very impressive, as Andy there. And don't forget, at the top of the page, our COVID-19 index. Biggest rise of the day is Novacyt, up 15%, 427. Biggest faller, Cromec Group, down 4% to 15.6. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
Welcome to the podcast and video. Joining me as ever are bi-weekly, I like saying that, bi-weekly or fortnightly, it's Paul Hill, of course, equity analyst, full-time investor, very enthusiastic guy. Guy doesn't sleep. He's looking at stocks, looking at the markets all day long. He's literally worse than the crypto traders. You know, the crypto markets don't shut. That's why you got so many crazy people who trade crypto, because they haven't had any sleep. That's a bit like Paul, but he's on the equity side.
Yeah, well, you've just made a brilliant intro for you there. So I've just heard on Twitter that you've decided to actually have a little dabble at Bitcoin. What's the logic behind that?
Let me say one thing, right? You wouldn't understand it because...
No, I don't.
Because I tell you why, because you're a fundamental guy, which is, you do very well on the fundamentals, and you very really look at the chart. With Bitcoin, there's no fundamentals. You can't value those kind of things, like 700 billion is worth, you know, which is ridiculous. So all you can look at is a chart. But you can look at what's behind this, right? And this is what you said to me, because I looked at the chart, and I've been looking at Bitcoin for a while, and this is a very bearish-looking chart. It's rolling over. And I'm not forecasting. I'm saying when these metrics last hit, it's sold off by 52%. And I'm talking about the relative strength index. And, you know, Bitcoin momentum is so strong, you hardly ever get the RSI coming down below what's 50. You know, it's 0 to 100, the scale is. I said, now it's just about to hit 30. Last time that happened was in the Dash for Cash in back in March. It sold off 52%. So this, all the Bitcoin got people saying, yeah, buy more. I said, no, I wouldn't do that, buy more, because it's just a crazy sell. I mean, it's going to fall over. It's going to roll over. The selling begets selling. You'll see that happening. And it is starting to happen. But you said to me, hi, share pickers. Are you really saying you've just purchased some Bitcoin?
Yes.
May I ask why? Given there's a real possibility that the US adopts similar restrictions as imposed in Turkey, China, India, etc., environmentally and money laundering too, crypto mining is a nightmare.
Those were mine.
You're just doing that for likes and popularity. Now, you're speaking like an old man. Are you really?
Now, I just want to be 100% crystal on this one, Justin. So this is a trade, as I understand, for you. It's not an investment. It's a short-term trade to see whether you can make a few buck, yeah?
Now, this is what it is. Right? I put less than half of 1% of my entire sort of liquid portfolio into crypto. That's all I've done. Because I want to be in it, because it's very interesting. Let me say one thing about Bitcoin. I question it on three areas, right? Let's look at the asset status of Bitcoin, because people say it's a new gold. And I believe it probably is a new gold, because kids of this generation are not going to be buying gold. My nephew, who's 20, he's all over crypto. Most kids that age are. It's so easy to transport in out your wallet. Unlike gold, if you buy real gold, you go, I don't know, you store it, you get someone to store it somewhere, right? Stuff. It's hard work, right? So I think it is, for this generation, it is the new gold. So the valuations of more than a trillion market cap, I don't think it's fanciful. I really don't. It can be the new gold. And is it an asset? Yes, it is an asset. And that's why all the fund managers are getting into it. If you've got an asset that's performing very well, it's outperforming every other asset. Fund managers say, why haven't you got exposure to that asset? So they buy some, it becomes an asset. Same as gold. Gold you can't buy anything with. It's useless. Ready to press gold? Is it a little bit of industrial stuff here? Now, environmentally, gold has never been good either on environmental levels. You know, if you look at the ESG model of gold, there's been wars, there's been mining, there's been communities broken up of gold. It's one of the worst carbon footprints ever, gold. So you can't compare gold and Bitcoin together on that, right? And also, Bitcoin is actually driving now innovation in this field. I mean, most of the farms, of course, are in China. They're using probably coal-powered fire stations. But everyone's target is carbon zero by 2050. This will drive. There's so much money in Bitcoin now. It's driving it. In fact, it's already happening. There's already coins being mined off renewable energy, wind, and solar. So it'll drive that anyway. And as far as regulation is concerned, most of these countries, questionable countries like China or Turkey, you can't compare the US to the UK, but to China and Turkey and India even. You can't compare them. But they are adopting their own cryptocurrency. To me, that validates the tech behind it. So that's why I'm very interested in this area. That's so in all standards, you know. So us old fellas, we don't really understand it. Because I looked at the smallest, cryptocurrency on Coinbase. It's valued at 145 million. I thought I wouldn't touch a company on the stock market at that level. So it's nuts. It's completely berserk. And I said to Glenn, who's a writer of cryptocurrency, I said, these cryptos need a 95% sell-off to make them even attractive, really. But the hype is there. Why is the hype there? Is it built on nothing? It's not. The tech is very good. Bitcoin's never been hacked into. And the best hackers are in crypto. Never been hacked into ever. So
I'm glad. I tell you, I am glad we're taping this, because this is evidence. Let's park it and let's see what's happened.
I think they need a 95% sell-off. I really do, because it's nuts. We are in too much territory.
One last question, yeah? If you're using it as a trade, yeah? What do you bring of insight to that trade, which is not already known? I mean, it's just a punt, man.
With Bitcoin, not so much. Ethereum, every sort of development now is based on the Ethereum network. I think Ethereum, the market cap is still sort of ridiculous, but it's not anywhere as big as Bitcoin. But I just think if you want to, after a big sell-off, I genuinely think it's a lot easier to hold Bitcoin than gold. I just see it as a store of value, really. I do an asset. It'll probably outperform gold now forever.
Okay, right. Let's move on to a real business, mate.
I agree. We can laugh and diss it and move on. But listen, when you are not in the best performing asset in the last 10 years, you've got to question, in fact, maybe I should have had a bit of exposure. And there are guys a lot better than us into it, you know? I mean, there's like, who's that guy who's in charge of Virgin Galactic or Virgin Space? He's a billionaire. And he said a long time back, and I saw he said, even if you are the biggest cynic...
Are we talking of Richard Branson or Chamath Apatia?
Yeah, Chamath, yeah. He said, even if you are the biggest cynic of crypto, right? Just get a 1% exposure to it, just in case. And that's sort of, you know, what I'm doing. It's pocket money in there just to keep an eye on the markets. I quite like it. I like the tech behind it. It's very clever.
Okay. That's fair.
That's the reason why. So listen, you are a spreadsheet fundamental guy. I don't expect you to get it anyway. But, you know, even if with your wealth, all you need is like, 0.1% exposure. And you think, oh, that's quite exciting, you know.
No, I wouldn't touch it with the barge. Anyway, moving on to a real business. We've had two sets of news. In fact, we spoke about it about two or three days ago. First of all was Avacta coming out with the clinical trial results for its rapid flow test, which effectively are almost 100%, 98 to 99%. And then we had its prelims yesterday. And I was on the the call, and I'll tell you one thing which was a real takeaway. CEO Alistair Smith was really confident about the runway ahead for this business.
Shouldn't he? The best in class at that now, aren't they?
I know. But let's be clear about it. There's a lot of sort of noise going off in the sort of like the social media and on Twitter about the company. But cut through all of that, the guy who's actually been there for a long time, he is probably the most confident I've seen in terms of the business's prospects. I mean, not only are they absolutely in the sort of like, you know, the box seat when it comes to lateral flow. I mean, I think the company said it's the most accurate, almost sensitive lateral flow test that they know. And we talked about it, but it's not only because of its accuracy, it's also because of its ease of use, its anterior nasal swab, and obviously its speed. When he revealed some really quite interesting charts, and I would recommend people actually download the presentation, because the readout comes in 20 minutes, but actually it's a pretty good test in 10 minutes. So, you know, I mean, it's got really good time on sort of like speed, on ease of use, and obviously on the accuracy. It's just absolutely top notch. Now, putting that, just finishing up on that, the sort of timeline which he talked about was such that they're going to get CE marking hopefully in early May. And then they may even start making sales in May. And they've already lined up manufacturers. They've got Molegic, Abingdon Health, and I think BBI Solutions just in the UK. And they reckon they can get, when they really sort of like get the motor running, between 5 to 30 million units per month. Now, that is dependent on some government investment. But given the accuracy and the ease of use and the need for these things, then I actually think it's going to be well over 5 when it really gets going. And if you just run a sort of 10 million sort of like month at £5, just say, because they did indicate it was a mid-single digit type of pricing for large volume, they say that's 50 million per month. And, you know, that's a huge runway. So that's got, that seems to be really sort of like...
So what would you spend the margins on that to be then? 50 million?
Well, I would say, I mean, I know the government is going to hit them hard in terms of margins, but I would say minimum 30% gross margin, and most of it will just drop through to the bottom line because there won't be any sales and marketing associated with it and any other costs. So that could just be enormous. But that's just in the UK. He did say, which is absolutely fascinating, and again, I'd say to people, have a look at the tape and stuff, strong demand in Europe, yeah? And they could easily do quadruple that, I believe, in volume out in Europe. And then he's actually looking for, well, the company's looking for manufacturers in the US, because again, I mean, these are just enormous, enormous markets. So you've got a huge
What I'm worried about here is two things. Listen, I'm best in class. And whenever you look for a product that's in a competitive market, you've got to go for best in class. And so they have that. Now, my concern is this. First of all, the valuation already of Avacta is around about, 600-700 million?
Yeah, 610, I think it is.
Okay. And how long do they have? Will it take them to get this commercialized, do you think? To get the market? I don't know if you saw the news today, but they're saying there's studies out for saying that even one vaccination helps reduce drastically infection rates. I mean, Wales are opening up early. I think we should probably do that, because I've seen the hospitalizations. They're on the floor now. They're below 200. They're up at 4,000 a day at peak, and now we're below 200-day hospitalization rates. So I'm just thinking, how fast can they get this to the market and commercialize it? Because they've got the product, but they're just getting it to market.
I mean, he didn't give us a specific date, but I would say, given it's the 23rd of April, I'll have a guess. 23rd of May will when they'll basically be able to start selling these products? I'm just guessing because I don't know, but he did say, indicated it was going to be towards, you know, sometime in May as immediately, which means that they've already got volume in my view. I mean, MoLogic's probably already sort of like sorted this one out. So there's the rapid flow, which is an enormous opportunity across the world for royalties and for obviously for their own manufacture. But they're making very good progress with their chemo warhead prodrug, the pro-doxorubicin. And that goes into clinical trials in Q3 as well. And again, they're getting first sight of results on that one towards the end of the year. And again, that is a massive billion market. And he went through on the slides quite a few of the, you know, the other leading partners he's got across the whole world in terms of biopharma, across numerous different application areas. And, you know, I mean, the opportunity is massive. And one thing...
So you're not concerned that this is a lot of this is priced in already or still lots to go?
Well, if I was brutal, I would actually say, well, the share price at six, you know, basically the market cap at 600 million is predicated just on reasonable volume for the lateral flow at sort of 5 to 10 million. And then you get the rest of the business for free. And one thing in terms of the... When you come to valuation, one thing you come to you know... with their reagents for the Affimer technology, that actual platform, it's shone a huge light worldwide on how successful it is at developing rapid diagnostics for any type of infectious disease. I mean, just look at what's happening in India. They've started, you know, basically vaccinating hundreds of millions of people, but they've got a nightmare going on because they've got this double variant. And this is what you're going to need, leading cutting-edge technology to be able to test people. You're going to be able to cutting-edge technology to tweak vaccines. And we still need, and I keep banging the table, we still need a blockbuster breakthrough therapeutic. And that's why I also own... you know, basically Gilead and Merck. And so that'll be the last piece. But no, I mean, I've got, the key takeaways I took from yesterday's numbers, strong demand. Yeah. And I actually think in terms of, you know, the confidence of the team that, you know, we're going to start.
I just feel like, so I don't think the government, we've seen they're prepared to splash the cash if it's the right product to get this done. You know, we've seen that before. They splash the cash on buying way too many vaccines. You know, they go to, and if they can prove it's a valid best-in-class test, they will splash the cash on that
just
as well.
Just to give you an indication on what these type of businesses go for, it's billions, absolutely billions. I mean, Roche bought... A company that hardly makes any money at all, Genmark, for about $2 billion, $1.8 billion, only about last month. I mean, you know, that's a company without making any money. So, you know, I mean, you look at this sort of stuff. So, anyway, we'll wait and see.
Do you think you'd be proud of UK? The UK is still, you know,
yes, exactly.
Amazing, I mean, companies, you know, and
it's brilliant. I mean, you've got to tip your hat to these guys. And now. Another business that is...
Let me just say one thing quickly. I don't know when we were getting
this. Yeah, please do.
You're talking there about, you know, margins and valuation. Now, a couple of people in the club, you know, saying, how does Paul look at margins and valuations? Because I try and keep it simple. Now, you can go in depth, but I like to try and keep it simple. I do look at things like, you know, revenue, I look at the market cap and all that stuff, and I look at the, obviously, profit and the multiples of that, and then maybe a couple of peers, but there's different values. That's why people find it hard to get into shares and investing, because there's so many different versions of valuations. Like, you can go on profits or on revenue, you can go with market cap, you can go with EV. And so there's no right or wrong way, is it? But you've got to always try and value a company, I suppose. So if you're looking at margins, maybe it's gross margins, net margins, there's so many different moving parts.
Yeah,
so
I mean, just...
On a basic level, if someone's there sitting there listening to this and doesn't know anything about how to value something, what are you going to... What do you start off with, you know?
Basically, you look for what the key value driver is of the business. Now, let's just say software business... or pharmaceutical business, gross margins are roughly 80 to 90% because you're selling air or you're selling a pill, okay?
Yeah.
So what is going to be the biggest driver of value? Sales, yeah? Because most of that margin, the operating leverage, falls down to the bottom line. Hence, software and pharmaceuticals typically go off sales, okay? And some of these diagnostics who do leading edge are 10 times sales. And particularly if they're still pre-profits, you know? When it comes down to more mature business and you're making 10% EBIT operating profit margins, the key driver essentially is going to be just normal how much cash this is generating, yeah? which is effectively, so you look at your PE ratio, you look at your EV to EBITDA, your EV to EBIT multiple, and you can compare them against other takeovers in a similar multiple. And that will come on to the next one I'm going to talk about. And then finally, the other big sort of like way of valuing it is look at the asset backing of a business. So if you look at a house builder, a bank, you look at the actual assets, and then you do a multiple of book, because that's really the driver of value, is essentially really what is the business worth in terms of its, it's like a bar of gold.
Some of the banks at the moment, they're trading, are they still below book at the moment?
Yeah, they're cheap. That's the old, anyway, that. Well, come on.
I don't know if you saw, someone recommended me watch Dragon's Den. I was on the treadmill this morning watching Dragon's Den, and this guy on there with his fitness equipment, and he's got his margins all over the place. And one of the dragons said, so what's your gross margin there? And he said, what's your net margin? And he said, 60%, 50%, 60%. He said, what's your gross margin? He said, 12. So he didn't know the difference. I mean, that's not good if you go into the Dragon's Den pitching a business. You have no idea what your margins are. So, I mean, when would you look at gross? When would you look at net? I mean, that's because some people don't even know what gross and net is. And also, when would you look at EV? When you look at market cap? Because EV is obviously a more true reflection of the business, but it's easy to look at market caps. It's always displayed, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. I mean, basically, when it comes to sort of like most businesses, I as a professional investor, we look at EV simply because you then strip out any distortion in currently
debt.
Yeah. The problem you have is certain small companies, if they're heavily indebted, they then take on a lot of really expensive debt. And you would actually need to have then build that into your valuation, because it isn't fair to strip out a really expensive debt. Yeah. So EV is a purer way of looking at PEs, but you have to basically, there's no right or wrong. You have to basically just use your nous and your experience on that one. But
and try and always get a bargain, you know, value wise. You already, you must make it fanciful and try and say, well, it's already, you know, 10 times revenue, but it doesn't matter because they've got an amazing product. That kind of thinking, when you're a bit delude yourself, that can get you in a hot water, can't it, really? You always try and get a good value, you know, deal value wise.
Yeah. This is like this program's turning into a bit like Blue Peter, because I've just prepared one perfectly for that valuation.
Go on then.
I was a bit slow. I mean, you know me, I'm a bit sort of like Luddite occasionally. But I spoke to two really good investors before Christmas who I should have really taken a bit more notice. I do take a lot of notice of them, but I didn't really pick up on both of them. Anyway, it's Christopher Mills, of Harwood Capital, and Judith McKenzie of Downing, both own a company called Avingtraz, And this is effectively a niche specialist engineering company that makes sort of precision parts for...
What's it called? How do you spell it? Avingtraz?
Avingtraz. The ticker is AVG, okay? The reason why I'm sort of interested in it is because, one, those two guys, Judith and Christopher, both own it, and I really respect them. So I always sort of like, look at their portfolios. But
how do you? Let me ask you a question here. It's very, you're absolutely spot on here. And these people, of course, if they're at these funds, they often get approached by people a lot. So they often get the best opportunities first, don't they?
Yes.
So they're not only sharp investors, but they often get the best opportunities. And so it's always worth following. And I asked you the day, what's the best way to track these? There's a couple of funds like Gresham House guys. And they always get in. I've been researching companies, a funny company, and I look through the holdings and the Gresham House boys in there, the other people are in there already. How do I track these guys' buys? Because it's annoying, because they're always in there. They get offered the placings and all that stuff, you know. And you think, if I just track these guys somehow, I'd find some winners. Because
it's basically heavy lifting. You just have to look at the RNSs and do on them.
I was trying to come up with a new way of doing it. I tried to put a Google Alerts on. It didn't really work. You just got to troll the RNSs. You've got to do that. Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, coming back to my Blue Peter,
go on.
With Avingtraz, that alerted me. But what really sort of like caught my attention was they produced, their interims was in February, but in March they sold one of their subsidiaries, Peter Brotherhood. And what this sort of business does, it sort of buys sort of like, not companies in distress, but companies that they believe they can turn around, but really good quality business at really low prices. It then sort of like does all the heavy lifting, turns them around, improves margins, gets the products working, and then has historically disposed of them. And this Peter Brotherhood, they bought for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. I think it was part of the Haywood Taylor acquisition. And they sold it for four times what they paid it for. So for £35 million, which has put about £20, £22 million of cash, net cash now onto the balance sheet. It sort of highlights that actually this is a really undervalued company. And that's why you have those triggers when you look at those investors who are actually in. And then you see actually what the power of the management team, what they're doing. And it's headed up by a guy called Steve McQuillan. And I've actually spoken to him. He's a really sharp guy, Glaswegian, salt of the earth sort of guy. But he's done this before and he just keeps on doing it. I haven't quite finished all my due diligence, but then you sort of run the slide rule over its existing divisions. And these are, say, heavily regulated businesses with niche positions. And I'll give you an indication of the type of products they do. One of them's called Booth Industries, which does blast-proof doors, yeah? And they sell them into all kinds of things like nuclear and stuff. But they've just won a £36 million contract. Well, I think they won it in September of last year. £36 million contract to put blast-proof doors into tunnels for HS2 because nobody else can make these doors. And this allows for people to evacuate if the train ever gets stuck in there in a fire and stuff like that. So it's got those type. And it also what it does is provide really sort of niche, high, you know, sort of critical precision and performance critical parts into nuclear power stations, and likewise in high performance parts into other sort of like environments, and maybe into environmental or whatever, pumps and valves and this sort of stuff. So there isn't, when I say niche, this really is niche. And I think what Steve will do will be increasing the margins of this business consistently, and then you'll be unlocking more value. And I just look at it currently on the margins, and I did a sum of the parts, and I just put a 12 times EV EBIT multiple. And frankly, these type of businesses go for like 14, 15 times, you know, sort of multiples. And that's just on what they've got on a low margin at the moment. So I'll put it on a modest multiple, and I get sort of like £4.70 because they've got some bit of spare land in Luton they're currently selling, which will bring some money. And they've got the £20 million odd of cash. They've got a few, you take off a bit of sort of like the, you know, for some of the parts, some corporate costs. But those two businesses are really good, and they're doing I think they're on the hunt basically for more acquisitions. I'm sure they are, because they've got, you know, they know they've got this formula that works for them. And, it seems to drive value. And if you look at the share price over 10 years, it's gone up by 18% per annum, which actually, frankly, has just blitzed every single index, including the S&P and NASDAQ, by a mile. It may not have blitzed the Bitcoin chart, but frankly, it's done pretty damn well.
Yeah.
If you look at it over a 10-year period. And there's a
site. Look at that chart. Now, the thing is, the annoying bit is that look at the holdings in the company there. And most of the guys that go Harvard Capital, what are they getting down here? Somewhere like 260.
Yeah, yeah. They bought off another guy called Nigel Ray, who you may have heard, who's a long-term investor. But what it says is that this is this business, in my view, contains a lot of hidden value. And then a real lovely nugget on top, which I think is in the price for free, is they've got this they've just basically set up this business called Magnetica, okay? They own 58% or 59% of it, if I recall correctly. And this is developing cutting-edge technology to do small-form MRI scanners, largely for children, for, you know, gynecology sort of stuff, or alternatively for the veterinary. And they reckon it's a £400 million total addressable market. And of course, this will be a lower price point, easier to put in and easier to service. They're still some way away from commercializing it, and they're still developing the technology. But that's in for free into the valuation. And, you know, if they ever commercialize that, that will go for a big multiple of sales, not actual, you know, EBIT multiple. So this is like in my view, this is a business that actually has got a lot of hidden value. And again, another guy I actually sort of, I really rate is a guy called Simon Thompson, who's been in this, you know, for some time. And he's seen it, and he saw it early. But I think there's still quite a long way to go, because I was running.
Yeah, look at the chart there, though. All-time high, I'm going back to 2012, it was down at like sub-80 pence, and that was 340, all-time high. And I'm thinking, do you know what amazes me, though, is that you watch a lot of stocks. I watch a lot of stocks as well. and just how many stocks we sometimes don't even hear about.
It's not like
there's 10,000 stocks. I mean, like, what, 3,000 maybe? Less than that, though, on the market. But every now and again, I come up with stocks. Even if I'm looking subs for 20 million market, there's stocks I've never heard of. Where does that come from?
I think the difficulty with investors, you know, in the past is actually because there's a lot of moving parts in this business, it's quite difficult to sort of like unpick it and unpack it in terms of what's in there, what's not in there, and how to value it. But again, I haven't finished all my analysis, but I'd point investors, put this onto your stock watch list and have a good look, because it looks like a significantly undervalued company just on its current metrics. And I think actually, Steve, and the other thing which is actually quite good is that not only has it got the biggest shareholder, Christopher Mills, who I really, really rate, and Judith McKenzie, Steve is obviously the CEO who's doing a great job. But the chairman also, I really rate, and I've followed and invested with him before in the past, a guy called Roger McDowell, and he's absolutely one of the sharpest pins in the box as well. So, and he's got plenty of shares in this business. But I think there's two areas. One, you've got a fundamental hidden value, and you've got upside. And then the other side of the coin, if they can actually accelerate their growth rate, organic growth rate, and increase margins, then you'll see a multiple expansion as well. So you've got a double. I just did a hypothetical. If they did a 10-10, i.e. 10% organic growth plus 10% margins, I could see this over £7, which would be double where we are. But hey, I'd say just everybody have a look at that, because I think it's a very, very interesting opportunity.
To be honest, if you look at the chart, it's not without its drawdowns. It does come back a bit. So, you know, you can, again, always do some research. If the share price is at an all-time high, don't just jump on it. You know, just do some research, because the market has, you know, sell-offs. It always does, you know. And it's almost, I always find that, conquering that, you know, impatient side of it. I mean, you're quite good. You'll talk about stocks, and you know, and you're not getting involved for a while. That's the way to do it, isn't it? Because there's always opportunities in the market, isn't it? Always, you know?
You get buttonitis if you're not careful, if you're sort of like a bit impatient.
Yeah, yeah.
buy Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, no, the thing is, you know, I know you, for example, don't look at charts too much, and you look at the valuations and you'll base it on that. And but if you're finding a company with a good valuation, the chart should be good anyway, really. It should reflect that. Sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it's a disconnect. But if you're buying a cheap, you know, or good value business, think that's quite good value, then the chart will obviously not be at an all-time high, pretty much.
Justin, you tell me, what's your thoughts on the UK housing market? Because I spoke to Andy Brough a couple of days ago, and again, it's a great video. He's top draw, that guy, so people watch it. But he was talking about the housing market. What's your view first?
That's the thing, do you know what? Because I don't now have any house builders there.
Just housing market.
But listen, isn't it? Has there ever been a market more bullish in the UK for such a long time? It's never going to be bearish. We've always heard rumors about, there's, you know, the house price is going to drop by 5-10%. No, they won't, because there's buyers there. You know, there's always buyers there. And, you know, it's one of the traditions of every, you know, going back as far as you want, get yourself on the property ladder. That's almost indoctrinated into us, you know? And so it's almost like, you know, these people who are obsessed with Bitcoin, that's been the housing market in the UK forever. You know, there's been buyers all the time. So there's never going to be a 20% sell-off, because there'll be, even billionaires will just buy up swathes of property and land and everything, you know, institutions, because it'll always be bullish. So, listen. It's forever bullish, isn't it, the housing market? You love little dips now and again.
Well, in that case, then, you've just swayed me, because, you know, I've been investing in Taylor Wimpey for some time, and I've made very good money out of it. I'm up 50%, and I had a decent-sized position. So, you know, it's a good profit returner. So I'm sort of like thinking about, and they traded about 1.6 times book, 1.7 times book, which is in line with the rest of the peers. And I think that's fair value at 185p. And so I'm sort of like thinking, oh, should I take some money off the table? But you've just convinced me, because I've got the same view. They're paying a good dividend. There's a lot of solidity to the housing market at the moment. And frankly, it's a good place to be as an inflation hedge. And I'll pick up a nice dividend yield, even if the prices don't move up.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I'd say is, has sentiment got ahead of itself a little bit? You know, because we are now, if you look at the charts, I mean, shares, look at the chart of Taylor Wimpey, it's not far off. The big top was up here at £2.40. You know, and let's be honest, it had a big, fast rise. So take that top off a little bit and say, we are now back to this pre-toppy levels where it rose quickly from December the 30th, 19th to February. It rose very quickly. Just cut that off. And we are back to like sort of April 19th levels now. So are we a bit ahead of ourselves? Maybe it just needs to go sideways. We always think in terms of up or down. It can go sideways, you know. Yeah. It can go along like that. And you meanwhile, you're picking up the dividend. So,
you make a very good point. Consolidation is healthier. Consolidation phase. And I would say, in terms of if somebody was putting new money into the housing market and looking for a housing stock, I mean, Andy Brough came up with two great names. Vistry, I'd have a look at. They're about 1.2 times sales, so they're 20-25% sort of like cheaper. And the other one he came up with, Crest Nicholson, again, is about that sort of level. So that would be where I'd put new money, but I'm not going to sell Taylor Wimpey. They came out with a really good sort of like trading update last week saying they're in line with expectations, prices are firm, and they're looking to increase margins to 21-22%. So
I really like that video with Andy Brough. I really warmed to
him. He's brilliant, isn't he? He's brilliant.
You know, he strikes me as the kind of guy. Me and you are a bit obsessed, you know. He strikes me as the kind of guy who makes £1 million on the golf course, you know.
And
casually, you know. Yeah. Me and you have to, you know, put a bit of work into it. But it seems like he gets it very easily.
Yeah.
And it comes to him as in obviously years of experience where you think that, but to make it that easy in looking, you've got to have lots of experience.
And he's front row box office, isn't he, old Andy Brough?
Yeah, yeah. You'd never think he's a wealthy guy doing very well, but he's so casual about it, you know. So it's worth watching that video.
I would just finishing off on the house builders. I would say if you are in, you know, sort of like I am in Taylor Wimpey, then you need to take a medium to long term view on it and just say you're happy that if he goes through a dip. Because I'm with you. I think if anything, probably Rishi Sunak is not going to extend stamp duty holiday at the end after June because it doesn't need to. The market's just doing so well and we'll be coming out of the lockdowns, etc. And if that doesn't happen, then I think the market will take that not positively. But it won't go down much, but it'll go down. And on that basis, you're looking for a longer term sort of, you know, sort of like view on it. And if you own sort of like those kind of shares, then you might want to sort of top slice or take a bit of profits and redeploy elsewhere. But frankly, I've got nowhere else at the moment I'm going to want to put it in, and I'm happy to take a dividend and take a longer term view. But so
I'm quite surprised at and listening to Andy Brough actually talking is that how often they have a little bit of a trade and don't have just a long-term view in it.
They're
very flexible, you know?
Yes, I agree. I was quite surprised, actually, because I don't think Christopher Mills does that. He's basically fully in long-term trading, you know.
Argo blockchain, you know, and it's one of the things like that. And I did three videos in that company, lost my patience with it, and then went up by 3,000%. And so, which is annoying. But he was on
the 11th and shanked it, didn't he?
Yeah, he's on the 11th and someone says, go up 100%. He said, I'll sell it then. And then he realised, in fact, he sold a bit early. Things like that aren't aberration, you know, they don't happen very often. And like those 3,000%ers in a year, it does, you know, like I say, and Novacyt as well, you know, 60 times in 1 year. That's like really special situations, you know. But so when you miss out on a stock like that, don't kill yourself, you know, beat yourself up about it, because it's no one can foresee that ever happening, you know. Yeah. No one. It's hard work, isn't it?
Anyway, I know you spoke to a couple of companies that I follow. You spoke to Jay LeCue of Source Bio after its prelims a couple of weeks back, and likewise with Sarah Barrington of Verici. I think it's probably worth just covering quickly because Source Bio, the shares.
Jay, very sharp guy, very smart guy, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
You can see what he is. And even looking at him, he looks very smart. You know, I think for his age, he looks a very good looking guy, very well turned out.
A bit like you, Justin.
Yeah. But I was very impressed with the operations. Again, you know, they pivoted that business into a very hot space very quickly. And that always tells you something about the management. If a management can do that, let's be honest, when COVID locked down, they weren't in the ideal position. No business was. But then all of a sudden, they almost caught the big wave. You know, they were a switch, pivot straight away, catch it. And that says to me that they can pivot back out as easy as they can pivot back in, you know. And so they understand that was a hot time. They've earned a lot of money there. So I quite liked Jay a lot. But what I liked talking to Sarah Barrington is I didn't realise how big that kidney market was.
Massive, isn't it?
It's comparable to the lung cancer market, which everyone knows.
Bigger than lung cancer.
Everyone knows that's a big market. But yet, and the fact that they have, you know, a position that market is unchallenged in one of the areas.
Yeah, the immunodiagnostics, basically for kidney transplants.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking that is one to put on your watch list, and it could be a multi bagger. And it's the kind of company that would go quiet for a while, and the share price may drift. And so if you do research on it, you can pick it up, you know, maybe a decent valuation here. But it could do very, very well. You know, it's one of those companies that could do hugely well, and yet nobody knows about it. So, yeah. What was
quite interesting was actually this week, Renalytics, who are like the granddaddy of kidney diagnostics out there. They don't do the kidney transplant diagnostics. They do the front end of it in sort of screening. And then once you're actually sort of like into sort of treatment of kidney disease. But they just picked up a massive 10-year contract with the US government. And what that says to me is that there's more focus and more money being urgently put into kidney treatments. And they're going to be a beneficiary. Their product could hit the market when there's a flood of money coming into it. So it could be really in the right place at the right time. And what I liked about Sarah Barrington's sort of like, you know, the prelims in particular, when you spoke to her, and it was really interesting when you pulled sort of like some of the details out, but they've just signed that new contract with Mount Sinai, and that gives them 60 samples almost overnight to include within their clinical validation, and they're only looking for like 200. So they've got about a third or 30% already. And what that means is that it's almost like guarantees they're going to get results by the end of the year. And I think she's a really ingenious, you know, sort of like business person. I think she could accelerate that whole process of bringing those products to market because she's doing a great job at the moment. And I think there's every chance that they made. I'm not saying they will, but I'm just saying there's every chance that they could do. And their biggest, closest competitor is a company called CareDx, who have got the current standard of care, and they're valued at nearly $4 billion. it just shows the opportunity.
I know. And what's nice, though, is that we had the IPO hype here, and it started at, let's be honest, we bought the IPO. You talked about them.
It was ridiculous.
I didn't pull the trigger. 20 pence of,
it was ridiculously pence. Undervalued at 20p. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was it was a gift for people.
Yeah, look at that. Double topped right at 94 pence. It's come down at 70 pence, which is nice, consolidating. And so this is the time to start doing some research on them because,
total market cap is just about 100 million today compared to a runway of literally billions. So, you know, you're right in terms of the opportunity here. And the other thing, which is again, which I like as well, into, you know, Source Bio, and I've been banging the table about these guys for some time because they're a quality outfit, and Chris Mills owns about 30%. And on that video with Andy Brough, who did he defer to when it came to life sciences? He said, my antennae pickup with Christopher Mills is involved.
Yeah, he just jumps in. If he's recommended a health doc.
Exactly. Well, you probably find old Andy Brough wants to get into these guys. Now, what's interesting is the shares have come off a bit because, you know, some of the gas has been taken out, the testing market across most of the testing stocks. And at the moment, I mean, they're undervalued, and I think you get the PCR testing business for free because if I ran the sum of the parts on Source Bio, and I was getting a fair value of £2, £2.20, and that's on modest valuations, and that's without the COVID testing part of it. And there's still, frankly, going to be masses of COVID testing, PCR, and I think they'll get into lateral flow, and I think they'll get into the next. And genomics is doing really well. And the other thing, which has hit them this last 12 months. Is that obviously their biopsies and their cancer screening services they do for the NHS hasn't happened because we've got 4.7 million people on waiting lists. And that's just got to happen. We're just going to have to get through that. And they're in an absolute A-ball position to be able to help the world, certainly help the UK get through that mountain of patients who desperately need care and they haven't been able to get into hospitals. So I could equally see them get this huge sort of like tsunami of demand in just their base business over the next 2 to 3 years. And that's what he said in his prelims, substantial, you know, sort of like pent up demand and order book.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I keep saying, if you're looking at getting into some of these, you know, companies that are in the hot space of COVID testing, make sure they've got a decent business to pivot into once this cools down. Because he did say, actually, Jay, there was and you mentioned the company Boston someone, they have predictions for the peak of the testing. Was it?
Boston Consulting Group. Yeah, Boston Consulting. That's a bit out of date, but yeah, that's right. Yeah, at least a third of what the peak is going to be ongoing. And I would agree. There's no doubt about it. You just got to look at these. You know, double mutation out in India. I mean, it's just absolutely ravaged that, you know, states.
I was always surprised why India didn't get a bigger wave previously. I thought, why? Because they've got these, you know, these big cities, you know, lots of people sharing similar, you know, rooms. Mm-hmm. I thought, why haven't they got a big peak there? And of course, sometimes there's a lag like we've seen recently with ours, but it's nice to really have this vaccine program kicking in here because you can see a massive effect. And like, and I always go back to that stat, 80% of the people in hospital through COVID were over 80. They've been done. They've pretty much been double vaccinated now, you know. So luckily now, hopefully, our hospitals will not be paralysed by a new wave, new variant. But we still have to be, you know, very vigilant. Like I say, testing, that's where that comes in. And that's where that helps. So, I do feel like we're going to have a decent rally in, you know, this next month towards the opening. Maybe Boris will even bring it forward a bit. I don't know if he will, because, you know, the Welsh First Minister is electioneering a little bit. He's brought the dates forward. But, you know, maybe I'm just thinking we'll have a little bit of a rally now. So all sort of leisure, hospitality, even banks, all that, you know, forward-facing economies, that retail economies, all that's towards May. And then, of course, you've got that selling May thing. But I don't think that'll happen maybe this year. Or maybe it will happen towards the thing. But maybe because April's a good month anyway, isn't it? So, you know, generally.
Well, let's just follow that one through, okay? So we've got this reopening. Retailers. Now, a theme which came through from both Andy Brough and from Jamie Constable. He's another guy who's worth having a look at, N plus one singer. He's a partner and chief economist. But the interesting thing that they pointed out, one of the many interesting things they pointed out, was that UK retailers, because of sterling now increasing to 1.4 against the dollar, their profits are likely to absolutely moonshot over the next sort of 12 months. And as you get that reopening double whammy, I mean, you just go look at the high streets. The Bullring was jam-packed the last couple of weeks. Now, but also, I wouldn't diss the online guys either because they've got the same benefit of sort of like increasing strength to be able to import stuff in. So as people want to spend, I mean, I would say, you know, that's not a, you know, crazy thing to have a look at is some of the retailers which are beaten down. And that's got a double effect because a lot of the worries over the UK commercial banks, the likes of NatWest, Lloyds, is that there's still going to be a hangover from COVID in terms of bankruptcies and non-performing loans. But if you get that last piece of the jigsaw, which is retail, which is really at the epicenter of those worries, and you get restaurants coming back, then frankly, all those billions of pounds that the banks provided for last year, like the US, their cousins in the US, they're going to start releasing them pretty soon.
Yeah, do you know what? It's very interesting because I don't know if you saw that, but analysts, it was in the Times this week, said UK set for sharpest economic growth since 1988. Of course, we had a bit of a forced sort of recession anyway, but analysts have upgraded their GDP projections for 2021 amid signs that households are itching to get out and spend. And I did talk to this about Russ Mould, and I said, it's odd that because with most recessions, you get most casualties coming out of the recession, of course. But this is a different kind of recession. People have been supported. They've been furloughed. They've had grants. Yes. So it'd be interesting to see whether we have that level of of businesses going through.
I don't think we will. I think what's going to happen is that those businesses who have managed to get through the valley will continue to be supported, and they're going to see rocketing demand over the next sort of 6 months. And that's going to be just mainly for experiences. It's like your escape hunt and people
I didn't want to bring it up, but I was saying, I just genuinely think on sentiment alone, you know, I did tweet out, so 25 days left until the reopening. There's only 15 trading days for the market with the bank holiday. Mm. So, and people can see the sentiment building. So maybe a good time for most hospitality leisure companies now, next week or so, I think we may start seeing a little bit of a rally, you know, in banks as well, because...
I think banks is... I mean, I still own Lloyds. I bought them, you know, this time last year. And, you know, I think it's easy to go back to net, you know, I value them on a book value, you know, sort of net tangible assets, 55p by the end of the year, no problems at all, particularly when they put back the provision. So I'm happy to hold.
Let me say one thing. How many stocks now? And you were thinking.
I still own the Baker's dozen, 12 plus my house. So, I've got a nice split between sort of technology, healthcare, old economy coming back, and some industrials. And the last one I own
is Northbridge, which again put out some prelims. And I'll tell you, again, I mean, I know I'll keep banging the table about this. I must sort of like, you know, be a bit boring, but the new exec chairman, Peter Harris, I interviewed him about a week ago, 10 days ago. He's really grabbed this business by the scruff of the neck. And when I first started talking to you about Northbridge, it was about 70p. It's now on about 105, 110, something like that.
112, I'm looking at.
Yeah. Okay, well, hey, more people are starting to realise this is a real good turnaround. And the reason why I'm now more excited about this company than I've ever been, and I own quite a number of chunks of the shares, is because he's really doing, effectively he's doing an Avintraz, he's unlocking value. He's not only sort of like, it was your piece of advice, actually, I think it was to sell the Tasman business. So they're looking to just, they've had a couple of preliminary offers for their Tasman, which is a drilling tool business, which does geothermal and gas drilling down in Australasia. They're looking to sell that in the next couple of months or so. And he's also, I mean, expanding production, not by 5%, not by 10% at Crestjig, by 50%, which will come on stream next year, just because the demand for these load banks is frankly off the charts. And the reason why, just look at what was in the news this week. The US and Europe committed to reducing climate, you know, carbon emissions, improving the climate. Now, they're going to need more renewables. Renewables make the whole grid unstable. You need a load, you need more businesses and more organizations are going to need uninterruptible power supplies and backup power supplies, which will need to be serviced by these load banks. It's a no-brainer. So Crestjig could really go through an absolute sort of like growth surge over the next 5-10 years. No problem about it. They'll sell hopefully they'll sell Tasman for a reasonable price, not brilliant price, but a reasonable price. That'll sort all their balance sheet. And the other thing he's doing, which is absolutely spot on, is to either pay off or convert the 4 million of convertible debt they've got there. And that converts at about 90p. And once you've done that, I mean, the business is absolutely funded fine. And it's just going to be organic growth story, that. And if that happens, then these businesses will go for 2x book. And it currently trades on just over 1x book. I mean, you can easily see this be £2. I have a fair value. I think I've ticked it up to 185p from sort of like 175p. But frankly, that's still pretty cheap, modest. So anyway, I think he's doing a great job. He's doing exactly what is required. And the other thing which is worth noting is some super smart investors are also on board of that, which is Gresham House. You've got Richard Staveley and Lawrence Hill, who I think have also been helping them out. And I just think with that team there now in place, with their strategy, it comes down to execution. But the word...
No, I'm going to say, I'm not going to mention the company, right? But the Gresham House guys, I'm trawling through RNSs, right? And I only tend to look at companies' microcaps. You know, my ideal position is microcap to midcap. That's what I want to achieve. Just get a company that's a microcap and go to midcap. And I was looking through the RNS, and I saw Gresham House take a position in the company. I'm not going to say what it is, because I haven't got a position. I got a small position, but I want to get more of a position. And then they took a big chunk, and they announced going up. And where's the dip here?
You won't get it. That's gone.
It's annoying. And I don't want to push up even today, it's up double digit percentage wise. And I've got less than a 5% exposure to it. So that's so annoying. When that happens, it's so annoying, you know.
Yeah,
well, but it's in a nice way. It's gone up. And so I don't mind that. It could be worse. But what do you do? Do you know what? Just think about that, actually. There's two companies, Northbridge. That's like a portfolio. I was asking you how many you had, because you were thinking about maybe selling a bit of Taylor Wimpey. That's always, you know, your portfolio is only as good, really, as the weakest, you know, lot. So, you know, that's why having too many shares. If you own too many shares, you'll be dragged down. Your portfolio performance will be dragged down by the losers. So, yes, you can diversify massively. Because I know people who've got, you know, haven't got a huge amount, big pot, but they've got like over 20 shares. And you shouldn't be doing that. You're not going to achieve decent reward if you've got 20 shares plus some funds and all that stuff. You've got to bring it down and focus a little bit on the good ones and really do some deeper research, you know, and then have a fund if you want to diversify. You're not a fund. You don't hold millions of pounds to allocate. You haven't got that, you know.
So you've got to. That's why.
In my view, it comes down to your risk tolerance and time horizon.
Yeah, yeah, it does. It does, absolutely. If you want to achieve, multi bags, or you want to get revenue multiples of what you put in, you can't be holding 20, 30 stocks. You can't hold 20, 30 stocks. You know, you can't do that. It doesn't. Yeah. So if you want to take on a bit more risk, you're going to take on a bit more risk, full stop. But that means you have to do some research. And I like Buffett's. I don't know if it's Buffett's. They're always attributed to Buffett. But he said something about. Diversification is for the ignorant, basically. You can diversify, you can protect yourself against risk. But you also against reward as well. And so, there we are. But that's the same with Northbridge here. Stick with the company that's most potential, stick with that one, sell the other one.
Yeah.
And then people can focus on the company more then, properly, can they? You know?
So, I would say, just big picture, when it comes to sort of, there's two things. Just finishing off Northbridge, I mean, Peter said basically it's going to be a transformational year, 2021, and I think it is for shareholders as well as actually for the business. And then just top level in terms of the equity markets, you know, we've actually got, as you rightly say, we've got there's a lot of good expectations, a lot of good news already built into share prices. But again, a really good point that Jamie Constable made from N+1. Yesterday to me was such that actually a lot of those analyst forecasts are probably pretty undercooked. So in reality, if you look at, because the market, Wall Street has been pushing up its earnings expectations, its profit expectations over the last 5-6 months since the start of the year. And that trend will continue. So actually the optical sort of like valuation of 20 times sort of like price earnings multiple for 2023, the two earnings, it looks rich, but actually it's probably a lot less than that. So I think if we do get a bit of a dip in the next couple of months, we could equally see a big rally again going into the new year. And I think it's a brave man to sort of like come out the market, because I actually think we could see a big jump later on as people realize the earnings power of operating leverage, because what it's done is cleanse so many businesses and made them super lean.
Yeah.
Super efficient, and with top line moving up so much, a large part of that is going to drop through to the bottom line.
No, I believe that. There's a lot more companies, have slimmed down, got fit. You know, they've had to get fit.
Have you been buying anything else other than Bitcoin, or have you sort of like or selling anything? What have you been doing in your portfolio?
To know that, you'd have to be a member of my Share Pickers Investment Club. I will be in a company that, it's not ready. I don't want to talk. I did in microcaps. And if I talk about them, it doesn't take a lot to make them go nuts. And they shouldn't go nuts at this level sometimes. You know, and I don't want to hype them up or anything. So not as yet. I mean, I'm happy. I've only got, I haven't got many stocks. But anyway, listen.
About six or seven.
Okay, right. So you've cut down a few. Yes, I will. I'll send. We figured this out in my chat group that we have. People want to know what I'm buying and selling all the time. I said, don't worry about what I'm selling. I get it wrong all the time. Don't worry about what I'm selling. And like I said, people sell for personal reasons, and sometimes I sell because my portfolio is too big, or I wanted a bit of cash because I think there's opportunities coming up. So it's personal to me. But I'm going to send out now a list of companies that are over 5% of my total portfolio value. That means I'm getting serious on them.
What percentage of cash do you hold?
I hold now about 11%.
Okay, so you've still got, even though you've only got not that many stocks, you've basically got a very concentrated portfolio, and effectively you're still bullish on the market. If you own 90% stocks, then you're bullish.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason why I'm holding that is because that cash is there. You look around the markets for new ideas all the time, but sometimes the gems are in your portfolio already. And I'm thinking, if I'm going to utilize this cash, it's going to be the top up on some of the stocks I hold already.
That sounds like
double down. I talked about your friend, your schoolmate, isn't he, from N1 Singer?
Jamie Constable, yeah.
So if you didn't watch the video, we'll put that audio bit on the podcast today as well, so people can listen to that. So
I'm now down, just because the stocks have done well, I'm now down to 3.5% cash. I don't think I've ever been as low as that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that means everyone should sell. Paul's very, very bullish. Top of the market. Let's get out of it. No, in fact, people said that to me on Bitcoin. I said, I dabbled a little bit on crypto. And so I said, that's the top of the market. I said, absolutely, it's the top of the market. So get out. But Bitcoiners will never admit it's top of the market. They say, yeah, we've had pullbacks like this. But this pullback, I think, is going to be very big in crypto. And let's be honest, it won't come down by 95%, but they should do to get a reasonable valuation on any of them. But there we are. But I think you have a big sell-off, and then maybe...
I'll just say to investors, I mean, you know, I've been investing like you have for decades, 30 years professionally, okay? My hit rate in small caps is just over 60%. It's about 62-63%. So, and that's the context that I now say, yeah, if I was going to say my two stocks, small micro caps that I think will do really well, and again, my hit, just to put it in the context of my hit rate's not perfect, to say the least, two every three work and one doesn't. Northbridge and Equals, those are going really, I think... Rockets. I mean, Equals, they said on the analyst call, March was a storming month for them. There's no way April's going to be any different. May's going to be equally large. It's building a base. It's building momentum, like Northbridge. I just think it wants to move higher. And frankly, it's massively undervalued. So if I was going to say two stocks in small caps that I own, that I'm really positive on for this year, above anything else, would be those two. But I'd also say, in the context that, frankly, I am far from perfect, my hit rate is only 2 out of 3, okay?
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, I'm just going to keep it simple, leave me one stock. The reopening of the economy, escape plan, it's only valued.
Yeah, no, I thought you'd say that one, yeah.
18 sites as yet, they're going to head for 50. They are a micro to mid-cap stock. The board behind them are very smart cookies. In fact, you know what? The CFO of escape plan is now, I think, a non-exec. And this other company I talked about, the Gresham House, had announced today, had a stake in. And I thought, yeah, Graham from Escape Hunt, CFO, was very sharp.
Can I just add to that, Justin? Yeah. I don't own any on Escape Hunt. However, just as a bit of anecdotal evidence of the popularity of that business, okay? My two daughters work for a company, financial services in Birmingham, okay? They have just opened a corporate account there at Escape Hunt because people are not going back to the office full time. They want to be able to do effectively team building exercises there. Yeah. They want to be able to use it as training. So, hey, you're not only going to get a whole bunch of consumers going back in looking for it, corporates are going to use it as a way to bring their teams together.
Business management, last point here, because we're dragging on, business management that can pivot very quickly are worth looking at. But I mean, if you were in Escape Hunt's position, you know, going back when the economy locked down, thinking, hang on a sec, that's all we've got is like, you know, these rooms that we have. They expanded from 9 rooms to 18 rooms during the lockdown, by the way, taking advantage of low rents and all that stuff. But then they pivoted to digital. Now, they did a game which basically replicated one digital game, replicated their entire physical site as in players in one game. And I happen to know that company was a multinational company, and that's how they've been doing their corporate stuff. They can't get everyone together anyway, even after lockdowns happen. They're so big.
Yes.
But they've been doing those kind of calls.
It's a new market, isn't it? Onto their existing business, and it's growing. It's going to be massive.
It didn't exist until last year.
No, I know.
It's starting to take off. So,
their total addressable market has probably doubled.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. It's like going from, you know, it's like having a big rugby match that, say, 70,000 people watch live, and then you look at the people who watch it on TV or whatever that's where it's gone to, you know? Yeah. Anyway, lovely stuff. If you want to subscribe to this video channel, hit that subscribe button, notification bell, and until next week after next.
Happy investing, everybody.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
Yeah, I'm in good health. Thank you. Justin, you?
Yeah, all good. And I'm starting to feel the positivity. I mean, have you been back to London yet?
No, 4th of May is my first day back to shoot a video for the advisory side of our business. And then I'm actually seeing a mate for a bit of a cheeky glass of wine and a lunch after that. So I'll be testing the temperature, not just of the wine at that point.
Yeah, yeah. I was speaking to a sort of mining analyst who's based in London, but obviously they haven't been working in London. They've gone back to London for the first time this week, and he sounded really upbeat. And they went out for a few sherbets it's in Soho. It's like it's not shut because everyone's outside. It's almost like a bit of a Mediterranean feel. Everyone's outside. It seems very busy, but outside. But it seems like it's not in lockdown in London at the moment. So
my adopted hometown of Brighton feels the same.
Yeah.
And My lovely wife is traveling up to London 2 or 3 days a week. She works in White City for a lifestyle brand, fashion brand. And she says, yeah, London is throbbing, in her opinion. And her company's sales, I'm not giving away any names or anything, so it's not publicly owned company, but her employer, their store sales are extremely good, but online doesn't seem to be tailing off. So the shop stuff looks to be on top of strong online still, which is interesting. And I suppose that ties up with the retail sales numbers that we've seen, you know, this Friday, that were, you know, on the face of it, extremely strong. So those people who've kept their jobs, not been furloughed, their expenses have gone down because they're not commuting, they are clearly able to and in a mood to spend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know if you saw this. Said the UK was set for the sharpest economic growth since 1988. Of course, we've dipped down quite high. But they say analysts are now upgrading their GDP projections amid signs that households are itching to get out and spend. And itching. My wife is obviously, she goes to the shops all the time, every day.
Wow, there you go.
I say we don't have to spend, but surely that's going to help everyone a little bit. I mean, before we came on, I said, what are you going to talk about? You said banks. Now, of course, the banks are the oil, or the cogs of the economy.
The lubricant, the provider of credit. Yeah, absolutely mission critical. And it's important. It's intriguing because since the great financial crisis, they've been absolutely shocking performers. I mean, over the last 10 years, there are 40 sectors in the FTSE 350, and they're 38. Down over 40%, but in 2021 to date, they're the third best performing sector. So, and they're still cheap. They trade at, you know, the big FTSE 5 banks still trade at a discount to book value. Yeah. Now that's the stock market's way of saying either we don't believe the asset valuations, I'm terribly sorry, or a way of telling the banks that their returns on equity and returns on capital are just not adequate. Yeah. To justify a rating of 1x book value or more. So, you know, and an economic recovery would, in theory, be really good for the banks because it would mean that there's less risk of loan book losses. Mm. It might mean that, you know, bond yields go up a little bit and the yield curve starts to steepen, and that helps their net interest margin. Because in the end, let's face it, banking is a relatively simple business. You raise money at one interest rate from deposits or the wholesale markets. You lend it out at another. You lend it to someone you can pay the interest and pay your bank. You pocket the difference. Yeah. On that basis, it's actually terribly straightforward. But net interest margins have been slaughtered because interest rates have been crushed. Bond yields have been crushed by quantitative easing. Quantitative easing is designed to flatten the yield curve and erode that difference between short and long-dated bonds. So it's cheaper for people to borrow. Mm. And also, we do have a very indebted economy. So, you know, if you're a bank, you probably the people who you're really keen to lend to probably don't want any debt because they've got loads of money anyway. And the people who do want to borrow might be the ones you're thinking twice about because they've got loads of debt to start off with. So it is a difficult balance for them. But in theory, an economic recovery, good for banks, lower losses, steeper yield curve, slightly higher bond yields, happy day. So if you really believe in a tub-thumping economic recovery, the banks are a natural place to look because they've underperformed, they're cheap relative to book, and they are geared into the upturn. And we have seen excellent numbers from the main street banks in America.
Yeah, I saw that this week.
Bank of America, Wells, Citi. And one of the reasons why was that they took a lot of provisions for loan losses last year because of the pandemic, because of the recession. And things haven't turned out as bad as they thought. So they're actually starting to write those provisions back, and that is inflating their profits. Now, one or two of them have got investment banking businesses that are buzzing along as well, because we're in a stock market boom. There's lots of IPOs and M&A in the States. But the fact is that, you know, generally speaking, the loan loss provision write-backs have made the numbers look good. Loan growth still isn't brilliant. Deposit growth is still a bit quicker, so that's something to watch for. But the US banks have set a good trend. Now, they all trade at a premium to book value.
Yeah,
they all offer a higher return on equity than the UK businesses, than the UK banks. So again, that's something that the UK banks need to deal with. But at the moment, the Americans are kind of leading the way. Let's see what the big five FTSE banks have got to say in the coming week. You'll be looking for loan and deposit growth. You'll be looking for changes in impairment losses and possibly write-backs. And you'll be looking for whether the net interest margin is starting to bottom or even tick higher. And if those trends show positive, maybe banks will be interested. Now, it might be just a trade. I mean, banks have still got some fundamental challenges. You've still got record low interest rates and QE. You've got a very indebted world, so growth's going to be hard to come by without taking a lot of risk. And you've got competition snapping at your heels from fintechs, and you've got the regulator breathing fire all over, who was a legacy of 15 years ago, and PPI. So there are some big challenges there. So these might be stocks to rent rather than own, but if the economy catches fire, you can see why these stocks would move at least for a while.
So it's more a sort of sentiment. I mean, if you look at Lloyds, for example, right? They came down back in March last year, the Dash for Cash crash. They came down from literally 66 pence down to like 29, 28 pence there. They bumped it on the bottom. They went down then, even in September, down to 23 pence. And then all of a sudden we had November 9 vaccine day. Of course, Pfizer came out, so we got a vaccine. And they jumped, what was that, 12, 13% really on that day. And then they went up to like 34 pence, up to 40. And so they're almost climbing up slowly. But like I said, you know, like you say there, isn't it a bit of a worry still that, you know, we come out of a recession and a lot of businesses, they've been, you know, they haven't had to deal with cash flow because they got furloughed and all that stuff. They've been shut down, made grants and all this stuff. Now they have to get back to it. And they've got a bit more debt maybe. Isn't there a worry, like you say, more businesses are going to go through?
And if you look at the Begbie's Trainer, a financial distress report this week, they were saying that I think, you know, the jump in companies in financial distress was very rapid. I think it was 16% quarter on quarter, which is not. And you often see more companies go bust coming out of a recession than going into it.
Yeah.
Because as they come out of a recession, they need more working capital for stock, inventory, capital investment, and they don't have the money, and they often have legacy bills, you know, tax, interest. And that's when firms do flop over. So, oh no, banks are not out of the woods, but I think there's a possibility, looking at the American example, that they provisioned so aggressively for company failures and customer defaults last year that a lot of that is already priced into their loan books. And that's one of the bull points. But yeah, I don't think, if you look at these things over the long run, they're huge growth companies, because just the amount of debt that there is out in the world anyway and the competition and regulation they face. So the other good, what they do need to do, and the regulator allowed them to at the end of last year, was they need to pay dividends. Because if you're not growing fast, you can have a bit of a utility. And therefore, if you're not growing quick, you need to offer a big, fat, chunky yield. And before the pandemic, a lot of the banks were offering 4, 5, 6% dividend yields, or certainly planning to do so. Barclays has gone down the share buyback route. Standard Chartered's gone down the share buyback route. And it actually makes sense to buy back your stock if your shares are trading below book value, because that's earnings accretive.
So explain something there, because I know, you know, Buffett is a fan of that as well, buying back stock, isn't he, and all that stuff. Because so essentially, it improves the earnings per share, of course, because there's less shares you divide by the earnings. But
and also, you're buying pound coins at less than a pound, effectively, if you believe the value, if you believe the asset valuation numbers.
But what happens to those shares then?
They're cancelled.
Okay, so
the share count goes down, the earnings stay the same / go up, and therefore the earnings per share is enhanced. And as a shareholder, if you don't tender your shares, your percentage ownership of the company has gone up, so you have a higher claim on its cash flow.
So as a small cap investor, I'm used to dilution via equity issue.
Oh, yes.
Now, it's the opposite of that, isn't it?
It's the exact opposite of that. But I think what Buffett's axe to grind is with share buybacks, and he's right, is that companies often buy back shares at any old price. There's no discipline to it. So we'll buy them at a quid, we'll buy them at 10 quid. We're not bothered. I mean, only a fool would do that as an investor. Yeah, right? What's the aim of the game? It's to try and buy low and sell high. Companies run share buyback programs and spread the money around like it's confetti. Next is an example of a company that doesn't do that.
Yeah.
They always say, we're running a buyback program, and by the way, this is the limit that we're going to pay, because after that, it's actually not generating any value for shareholders. And but most companies, you look at their share buyback history, they're all absolutely all over the shop, which is just not how you would, you know, those executives wouldn't run their own share portfolios like that. So it's madness. But I think if the banks start to knock up the yields, again, that might be something that provides a little bit of support to them. But again, I mean, the big challenge is global debt. There isn't going to be much growth there. Competition is an issue. And if you listen to people like Russell Napier of Eric, who's been following this story of financial repression, you know, he says, look, the next big challenge for the banks is, well, are they already a quasi-government tool because of C-bills, CL bills, you know? The government's trying to keep as much debt off its balance sheet as it can and shovel it onto the banks. Will they be able to make a fair return on that? Will there be losses on that? Possibly, which again may be why, if you buy into that theory, the banks are a trade, not a long-term buy. Because if you look at Japanese banks, the poster child for debt deflation after a bubble bursting, the Topics Banks Index went down 90% from 1989 to last year, basically. And I think the UK banks are down about 70-odd from the great financial crisis. So they're getting there. But if you do fall into a debt deflation trap, and the Western Japanese banks are the last place you want to be. So, you know, some of this will be guided by your view of the macro as well.
Yeah. And, Yeah, as I say, I see the banks in, I'm thinking, yeah, I don't know whether, I genuinely think we'll have a nice rally. April is normally a good month for the markets, isn't it? And then they say, selling May. So I think we're going to, with the reopening approaching, because I know Wales has reopened certain things early and Scotland have, and we just had the vaccine news about one dose even is helps massively.
To
stop spreading infection. I think this the sentiment towards the reopening is going to power stocks a little bit, especially those faced the open economy, like leisure, retail, hospitality, maybe even banks. But I think then we'll get the realism of everyone going back to work and not many people spending and all that stuff. And it'll
if I was trying to be too smart for my own good, I'd probably start selling some of those stocks into that strength. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's probably me trying to be too clever for my own good, but that would be... something's obvious, it's probably not going to make a lot of money, is it?
No, I know, but you know what? Psychology of the market's very clever. We all think we're going to, people I know hold stocks and it's going down, and then they start going up, and they said, well, as soon as I'm on break even on this, I'm going to sell. And I said, you probably won't, because once you start, the share price goes up, your mind is affected by the share price performance, not the business underneath.
Correct.
The share price performance. When it's going down, you're questioning the business, and the business is probably as good as it was when it was a lot higher, the share price. Now, the share price starts going up, you won't sell then. But if it takes a dip again, you want to sell. So it's psychology. Yeah, you've got to realise it's hard to sell at the top because everyone thinks it's going higher. It's hard to sell at the bottom because buy at the bottom because everything's going lower.
Because you're too, if you're too frightened, you don't want to.
So that's why I love it. It's more about almost psychology than anything else, isn't it? You know,
it is. It's very hard.
Ross, thanks for that. Speak
pleasure.
To you next week.
I look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to be able to speak to capital markets expert Jamie Constable, chief economist and partner at M Plus One Singer. So, welcome, Jamie.
Hello, Paul. Good to see you after 35 years.
Yeah, I know. We went to school together. You were a bit 1 year older than me. Anyway, it's easy to be super bullish, like myself included, on the economy and equity backdrop, given they've got huge amounts of pent-up demand. We've had successful vaccination rollouts and also enormous quantities of fiscal and monetary stimulus are being ended. What's your sort of view on the economy and the investment landscape in general?
Well, I think the question is, I mean, you're totally right, everything you said there, Paul. It's how fast the bounce back's going to be. I mean, we've had, is it a W, is it a V, is it whatever letter you want to think of? It's certainly going to be a V. I mean, certainly in the US, the question in the US, is it going to be red hot or white hot, I think, is the economy there. They want to run it hot. You've had 1.9 trillion, you're going to get another 2.3 trillion, and then God knows what after that. Looking at the UK, obviously much more specific to us. We got the reopening happening now, and we've had first stats coming out from last week. We've chatted to a couple of companies. A private restaurant group told me that the average spend per head last week was 30 to 40% higher than pre-pandemic. So wow. I think that tells you how fast the bounce back in the economy is going to be. And the big question then is how long is that? How prolonged is that?
Yeah. And what's it going to mean, though, for sort of the investment landscape? Because, I mean, equities have obviously rocketed to the moon over the last sort of 6 months, have anticipated a lot of this very good news. Have we sort of brought forward some of the gains, into prices at the moment?
I think, yes. You know, the equities discount the future, as we all know. So they're looking forward to what they expect to happen. So, yes, I mean, markets are at all-time highs. We all know that. What does tend to happen, though, is analysts tend to underestimate the operational gearing on the way down, but they also tend to underestimate the operational gearing on the way up. And one thing that the pandemic has caused is cost cutting has been huge within companies. So I think what you have to look at when you're looking at companies now and looking to invest in the market is what is the potential for the bounce back for those companies? Where were they in 2019? Where are they now? What are you looking at in 2022, 2023? But I think the big thing you will see, I mean, there's a small company called Norcross in the building materials tiles. They've had 3 upgrades in 5 weeks. Yeah. I think that shows we're going to get a lot of upgrades coming through. And going back to the economic side of it, you're going to see GDP upgrades for the UK as well. So the momentum is going to be strong. It's going to be strong through the rest of this year. The market likes momentum at the moment. I mean, you can see it with equities. When you see momentum is about a lot of this driving prices, you're going to get that momentum. For the market as a whole, we are at all-time highs, so we have to be very cognizant that valuations are, you know, reasonably high. But that's what the market's there for. It's discounting this very strong bounce back in economic growth.
I think you raise an excellent point, because when you look at it on pure economics, you see the S&P 500 trading at over 20 times EPS, but the missing piece of the jigsaw is actually analysts have been slow to upgrade, and there's going to be a catch up. So actually, that what is that 20 times? It's probably only 18 times.
Yeah.
And as you rightly point out, when you mentioned with Norcross, if companies are increasing estimates and the analysts haven't caught up with it, then actually being that discounting mechanism, valuations are probably not as rich as people, you know, quite imagine. What one thing that's really been scratching my mind, and I know investors, is sterling. I mean, it's gone now 140 to the pound, and likewise, you know, we talked about sort of with inflation. What's that going to mean for bond yields? Because that gave a bit of a wobble earlier on, and now seems to have died down a bit. How do you see those two sort of variables?
Well, bond yields, you know, US is obviously the big daddy of the bond market. Mm. So the treasuries went up, US 10-year yield went up to above 1.7%. It's come back down a bit recently. And I think the market's scratching its head a little bit on that. What I think it's back to that. The equity market is looking for the upgrades. The bond market is looking for how big the bounce back's going to be. But of course, the bounce back hasn't really started yet. We're right at that kind of tipping point of the economy is opening up in the US and US and UK, maybe not so much in Europe just yet, because obviously they're behind the curve on the vaccination front. But let's go east and look to China. The bounce back there, we're talking about unbelievable GDP growth numbers. What was it, 18%, I think it was? So that was, it was 0.6% quarter on quarter, but 18% year on year. You're going to get numbers that you'll never see in our lifetime again in terms of the growth rates. But I think the thing is, the market now wants to see those growth rates coming through. So what does that mean to sterling? You're quite going back to your question. I think sterling should remain strong. Now, the big thing is flows move markets. You know, one of the first economists talked to me, flows move markets. And that's more the position. And that's more true for currencies than for anything else. Mm. So I think if people want to buy into the UK, they'll be buying sterling. That will drive sterling up. The sterling dynamics against Europe, I think, look very good. We've had a big bounce against the euro.
Yeah.
I would expect to see that continue, which is great for anyone when we can go on holiday.
And that's sort of largely reflecting Brexit and presumably the better vaccination rollout.
Yeah. Yeah. So you see that. Then you've got the inflation story, of course, which will drive the currencies on top. We've had some data today on inflation. It's moving. It's started to move up now. I mean, it's going to keep moving up to the back of this year. That's just the base effect of obviously very low numbers coming out. So you're going to see inflation move up. You're not going to know whether it's going to become secular in the economy or just transient until into 2022.
But what happens? Let's just put a throw a number out here. Just doing, you know, governments to basically try and rebalance the income and wealth effect, and they decide actually to increase people's minimum wages across the patch, both in the US and the UK. And they've already said they're going to do that because, you know, it's unfair society. We've had asset price increases. If they do that, then frankly, this whole argument that it's transient inflation, it's just going to be blown out of the water.
Yeah, it's retail price inflation, or CPI as we measure it now. That's not really the driver of secular inflation. If inflation is going to become secular rather than transient, it has to get into wages.
Yes.
Now, that's the key point. And you've hit the nail on the head, Paul, I think. In the US, you've got a Democrat government now, president. They talk about a $15 minimum wage. We have a minimum wage goes up every year here. And then so that continues to rise. It's not rising quite as fast as it has done, to be fair, in the UK now. But the other point in the US, of course, is the share of company income that is taken by employees is at the lowest level ever. And I think everything we're seeing in terms of tax rises, government, it's what we've seen with the pandemic. It's focused government's minds. They spent billions, trillions even. They now need to replenish their coffers. So corporate tax rates are going up. I think we will see that rebalancing towards the employee taking more potentially, and that could drive wage growth. But we won't know that, I mean, in the short term. The numbers will actually, you'll see wage inflation falling in the short term as the lower paid employees, you know, 20% of the UK economy, of the UK workforce on furlough at the moment, come back in.
Yeah.
So the short term impact will be a small fall, but then what will happen going forward is a key question. And to be perfectly honest, we don't know the answer to that yet.
Okay, well, let's just run a quick scenario then, because it's a major risk for investors, both professional and retail. The economists, some of the economists, are forecasting US CPI to hit 3% early next year, okay? Let's say it's not that transient. It doesn't drop back down to 2%. If you have an underlying base of 3%, then where is the 10-year Treasury going to be? Because if it stays at 1.5, you've got a real return for bond investors of minus 1.5%. I just cannot see that sustainable.
It's over 2%.
It's got to go up, hasn't it?
It's over 2%. It's definitely over 2%. I mean, it needs to return. It's going to return. I can't see how it doesn't return to 2% if we get the growth that we're talking about in the US. Yeah. And in that environment, you don't want to be in bonds. You want to be in equities.
Yes.
And it's clear. So where's, and as I said a minute ago, flows move markets.
Yeah.
If the flows are coming into equities because they're coming out of bonds, that's, you think about when bonds went up, when bond prices went up and up and up and yields came down for that, you know, talk about secular moves for a couple of decades, that money starts coming out. That's huge flows that have got to go somewhere. And in an inflationary environment, you know, high inflation is obviously bad for everybody. Mm. But medium inflation, well, you certainly don't want to be in bonds, as I said, but you do want to be in equities. So,
it's good for the government to rebalance their debt to GDP level, isn't it?
Of course, deflate the debt. That's you almost wonder whether that's what governments want. They want inflation so they can deflate their huge debts.
Really? No, I don't believe that. Anyway, you whet my appetite. Equities. So where in equities? What sectors, what particular stocks do you think are going to be the places to be then?
Well, I think in the UK, we're just looking at UK equities here. So let's look at the UK. You've got the reopening trade. The question on the reopening trade and UK domestics is how much is already discounted in the share prices.
Yeah.
As we said earlier, I think, as they do on the downside, same will be on the upside. People will underestimate the operational gearing of those businesses. So I think we will get upgrades. So I think you have to look at domestics, whether it's pubs, whether it's leisure, whether it's retail. The other thing on that, you talked about currency, sterling going up against the dollar is very good for the retailers because, of course, they buy most clothing, etc.
So people like Frasers and, you know, the old Sports Direct and those kind of guys will love it.
Yeah, there's
Primark.
Exactly. At the top, you've got AB Foods with Primark. You've got Next. And then as you come down, you've got a company that we're broker to called Studio. They will all benefit from sterling strengthening against the dollar because they will have more pricing power. And pricing power has been one of the key, in a low inflation environment, pricing power is everything.
Yes.
And a little aside on inflation there, just quickly. Every company we speak to, and we speak to a lot of companies, inflation is coming through. Yes. Every customer of theirs, Volex, we're a broker to, they've spent the first 3 months of this year putting their prices up.
Yes.
And the customer is going, yes, because everybody's putting their prices up.
Yes. So you want to be in stocks that basically have pricing power.
Exactly.
That can actually maintain. If it sees prices, input prices increases, it's got to be able to then increase its own selling prices.
Exactly. Yeah. So you need to be able to pass it on. If you can't pass it on, you're getting squeezed.
Yeah.
So there's domestics, I definitely think you should look at. Infrastructure, the one thing that we're going to see from the greening of the global economy, which is obviously essential, that we all need to see on personal as well as a business front, is infrastructure. The way you're going to do it is investing in infrastructure, whichever form it is.
Mm.
So on that front in the UK, we've seen through the pandemic, RMI spending. I expect that to continue. I mean, Travis Perkins last week, Tool Station, one of their businesses.
So this is gardens and people doing their roofs and all kinds of home maintenance, DIY.
40% like for like. And that's pre-pandemic hitting. So they will continue to do well. You know, people have got huge savings, which we haven't just touched on. I mean, the number I hear in the UK keeps going up every time I hear it. 150 billion, 160 billion, 170 billion.
Yes.
There's a number in the FT about the global amount of enforced saving that people have had to do.
Yeah.
So that's going to come into the economy. And that's another reason that we're going to get some huge numbers coming through and upgrades, I think. And upgrades. And equities don't tend to go down if they get upgraded, let's be honest. So that's where to look.
And then presumably staycations this year are going to be absolutely massive in experiences, not only obviously at restaurants, but
anything to do with theme parks or holiday destinations, you know, those kind of places are just going to be lapping it up.
Yeah, pubs, restaurants, anything to do on the leisure side is going to do well. I mean, are the government going to let us go on our holiday? We don't know at the moment, but you might think that, I think 2019, the UK consumer spent $62 billion on overseas holidays. Yeah. They didn't spend that last year. And it looks like we might not be going on many holidays this year. Where's that money going to go? It's going to go into the UK economy.
Yeah.
Closed move markets, going back to the point I made earlier. Just returning to infrastructure, you've got a huge infrastructure story on the US as well. So stocks that are exposed to US infrastructure are good to look at as well. $2.3 trillion to come in. They need all their roads. Anyone been to the US, the roads need rebuilding, the bridges need rebuilding.
So that's the likes of Ashted, isn't it? And people like that, I guess.
Ashted, Hill and Smith.
But in the UK, I mean, if they're cheaper valuations. So you've got your likes of your VP and you've got Speedy, haven't you?
Exactly. You think about HS2, what's that going to do? It's going to take huge capacity out of the market. HS2, whatever you think about it, huge capacity is going to come out of the market. That capacity comes out. Well, we go back to prices again and inflation, don't we? They're going to have pricing power because of that capacity coming out. So those companies should do well in this reopening infrastructure-led investment environment.
Yeah. And what about, I'll give you the last sort of like puzzle to solve for me, is what about city centres? Will people start living in city centres? They may not be working, going to offices, but will they come back to your build-to-rent guys and your students coming into city centres and all this sort of stuff? Are we going to get back to some semblance of normality for restaurants in city centres and just normal services for city centres?
Well, we spoke to a couple of restaurant companies in the last few days, as you would expect, because we had the reopening last week. They are still, they're quite cautious on their city centre restaurants. The key for city centre restaurants, you're not going to make money if you've only got people coming in on a Friday night and a Saturday night. You need that through the week trade as well. Mm. So you need the office workers to come back. It's very interesting at the moment. I mean, I'm in the city here. This week, you could notice a lot more people back. Each day, there's more people coming back. Mm. So that is the key for the city centre ones. You need the footfall of office, people coming back to the office, going back to work. I don't know about people watching this, but what's their feeling about going back to the office? What I found and we found here is that people come back, they reacquaint, they start chatting. They actually go, maybe it's a bit better being in the office. I definitely think we'll still have the split. It might be 3-2, 4-1 office and work from home, which is obviously very good for everyone's kind of personal point of view and personal health point of view as well, I think, looking forward. But that's the key for these restaurant companies. What I do think we'll see restaurant companies opening a lot more restaurants in suburbs. And maybe the dark stores you have, you'll have dark restaurants where they have the Deliveroo-led or Just Eat-led delivery from those. So they're cautious on their city centre restaurants at the moment because no one knows how many people are going to go back to the offices. But I don't know about you. Have you tried to book a restaurant at the moment?
Yeah, no, it's impossible. Absolutely. Well, I think everybody in the whole area where I live are desperate to go out from. And frankly, there's no free available seats in any of the places, the pubs or whatever like that. Just moving on. What sort of key risks should people look for, or should we say keep tabs on? I mean, are we talking about, an implosion in Bitcoin? Are we talking about higher sort of like a potential variant coming forward that is like hitting India already? Those kind of things that would obviously scupper this whole reopening side.
I think the pandemic, obviously the virus is a risk. We saw a bit of a correction in the market yesterday. That was on US Airlines numbers coming out not quite as good, but also the US saying they were looking at putting travel restrictions on for US, which would mean 80% of the world wouldn't be able to be, accessible for US residents. Now, that is a risk. I mean, because the market is, for certain parts of the market, that is obviously a risk because they're discounting now the fact that people are going to be able to travel again or people are going to be able to go out to restaurants. If we get locked down again, well, the market will switch.
Yeah.
So back into all the names that did well during the pandemic again. So it's flows of funds again. I mean, yields will probably then fall again. So that it will be good again for that technology part of the market and the NASDAQ and everything like that. So just the market
that,
will
just
move.
Just on that risk though, Jamie, let's just run that one because I think that's the biggest risk. I think you've hit the, you know, you've absolutely nailed it. If we do get another nasty variant which hits Europe, the UK, there might be different ones, but they hit the US, UK and Europe, for big economies, will governments just come up to the, you know, basically come to the rescue again and just carry on, spend? I mean, they're all in already, so why not carry on all in? So if we got this underlying put anyway for investors, at least for the next shot.
They've got no choice.
Yeah, I thought
They've gone as far as they've gone now. They've got no choice. They'll have to come back in. And if you look at the UK, the furlough scheme doesn't end until September. So that's already been stretched out. They've got no choice. They've got their money. They've put their money to work. They can't just withdraw it now. So, yeah, I think what would probably suffer the most in that environment are the holiday travel stocks. They're the ones that get hit the hardest in that environment because they look at New Zealand, look at Australia. They've got very much the pandemic under control, but their borders aren't open. You can't travel. They've actually got it out. They have actually got a... you can now actually travel between New Zealand and Australia and backwards and forwards, but you can't travel to anywhere else.
Yeah.
And that's maybe when you're in the UK, you know, we don't quite realize that. But these economies where the virus is under control, borders aren't open.
Yes.
You can't travel. So that's...
So let's just run that one. So we get a nasty variant. We go back into lockdown. Governments come up to the rescue again. And then equity markets go down. This is the $64 million question. Is that the time to buy the dip?
Oh yeah, it will. I think the market's interesting nowadays because you don't tend to get death by a thousand cuts, which is, where you fall 2% a day. You get flash crashes nowadays because of the structure of the market. So I think, yes, people will look to buy the dip if that happens. The money's going to come back. I mean, if it's a variant, they'll come. What has been proven so to date is that we can produce a vaccine very quickly, particularly with the Pfizer and the Moderna versions of it. And they can tweak it within 6 weeks to produce another vaccine that will hit the variant. So it's deferred, isn't it? It's recovery deferred rather than recovery gone away forever. But the market would not like it. Let's be blunt. The market would not like it. If we start, as you saw yesterday in the market, if we start locking down again, the market is not going to like that. So we have to, that is very much, as you say, that's a big risk.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thanks very much for your time and insights, Jamie. And really look forward to touching base again in a month's time.
That'd be great. Good to see you, Paul. Yeah, speak cheers. Soon. Thank you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five. Landor Resources, up 10% to 38 pence. At four, Novacyt, up 15% to 4.27. At three, Wishbone Gold, down 6% to 11 pence. At two, BPC, down 23% to 0.4. And at one, Barron Oil, up 26% to 0.12. Okay, it's time for the top five most read RNSs. They are as follows. At five, Issue of Equity and Total Rights at Vast Resources. At four, GeneDrive, excellent performance data for GeneDrive HCV test. At three, Amiga Diagnostics, director, shareholding total rights. And at two, Supply at Me Capital, financial calendar update. And at one, Novacyt, R&D and UK operational update. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.